Welcome to Contemporary Communications Conference. We have Christian Anders, also known as Lanu, performer and writer of the play, video, and book, The Man Who Created AIDS. He will be interviewed by Ned Potter, independent AIDS researcher, on the subject, AIDS as a Bioweapon, in the New York City 1978 Hepatitis B trials, and the smallpox eradication programs in Africa. Ned will begin with an introduction.
The main thesis of Lanu's book, The Man Who Created AIDS, is that AIDS consists of two animal retroviruses adapted to grow in cancerous human tissues. It was then injected, along with preventive vaccines, into gays and blacks, where it first caused cancer of the blood, Kaposi sarcoma, brain rot, as in sheep, and direct destruction of immune system cells, such as T and B cells, leading to all sorts of opportunistic infections. Lanu adds that, quote, the hepatitis B vaccine in American homosexuals and the smallpox vaccine in Central Africa were all government WHO, CDC, NCI, NIH, CIA funded, supervised, and controlled. There is no way these agencies could not have known the true purpose of these vaccines, which was to inject AIDS and cancer into gays and blacks. And especially now, so soon after the long-delayed revelations of U.S. government radiation tests on unsuspecting human subjects, the idea that AIDS is a man-made genocide program can no longer be dismissed as paranoia, as Dr. Alan Cantwell, dermatologist, author of The Cancer Microbe and 3 books on AIDS, says in the foreword to the book, The Man Who Created AIDS. To further support this contention, you cite the following documents. Number one. On June 9th of 1969, Dr. MacArthur, Deputy Director of the Department of Defense, testified at a hearing before a U.S. House of Representatives Subcommittee on Appropriations for 1970 for the Department of Defense. Dr. MacArthur's remarks on page 129 fall under the heading Synthetic Biological Agents, and I quote, the dramatic progress being made in the field of molecular biology led us to investigate the relevance of this field of science to biological warfare. A small group of experts considered this matter and provided the following observations. All biological agents up to the present time are representatives of naturally occurring disease and are thus known by scientists throughout the world. They are easily available to qualified scientists for research, either for offensive or defensive purposes. 2. Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism, which could differ in certain important aspects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory, in other words, resistant to, the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease. And number 2. In the Bulletin of the World Health Organization, Volume 47, Number 2 of 1972, under the heading Virus-Associated Immunopathology, are found the following recommendations. A systematic evaluation of the effects of viruses on immune function should be undertaken. The effects of virus infection on different cell types, such as macrophages and T and B lymphocytes, should be studied in greater detail. An attempt should be made to ascertain whether viruses can in fact exert selective effects on immune function. The possibility should also be looked into that the immune response to the virus may itself be impaired if the infecting virus damages more or less selectively the cells responding to the viral antigens. Thus, in 1972, they describe one of the essential ways in which HIV operates. Peter Duisberg, prominent retrovirologist and UC Berkeley professor, says that the HIV virus is a weakling and does not cause AIDS. And on page 192 of your book, Lanu, and I quote, only one in about 100 T4 cells in an HIV-infected person showed infection at any given moment, and only one in about 10,000 cells expressed the virus. If the HIV virus did infect only a few T4 cells, what then was responsible for the low T cell count in more and more men from the hepatitis vaccine trial? What destroyed the T4 cells, if not the HIV virus?
The answer to that is, first of all, I want to say that it is an irresponsible statement by Dr. Duisberg to say that HIV doesn't cause AIDS, because everybody who is HIV positive then would say, well, you know what, I heard world-renowned Professor Duisberg, I might be HIV positive now, but he told that, or he wrote and stated that HIV doesn't cause AIDS, so let's have sex. That is a dangerous, irresponsible statement, and I would like to debate him on that. On you know, and also I heard Mr. Rappaport say the same on TV.
Right.
I called him and said I would like to debate him on that, and his manager called back then later. I guess Linda is her name. And she said, since he's running now for, I guess, Congress or something.
Right, Senator Waxman's seat.
Yes, he would not like to discuss me or debate me in the Phoenix bookstore, for instance, or on radio or anywhere, because he's afraid that it could harm his position there. Now, to the question, why so few T cells are destroyed, there are different reasons for that. One reason is that the let's take the first case, the HIV virus enters the T cell and reverses via reverse transcriptase from RNA to DNA and is then in a proviral form inside of the T cell. And it is only maybe 1 in 10,000 here, or 1 in 5,000, I mean, this number varies, but very few T cells actually express RNA virus. Many of them, the virus is in the DNA latent proviral form and remains there. This latency is caused, amongst others, by the sheet part of the virus, because it's a lentiretrovirus, but we can come to that later. The problem is this. When the HIV virus enters a T cell, it injects its core, the two RNA strands, into the core of the cell, because that's where the reverse transcriptase process happens, reverse from RNA to DNA. The glycoprotein envelope of the virus, the coat, which is basically sugar, these protein particles remain outside the T cell. Not always, but many times. In other words, these are GP120, for instance, is one term for them, GP120 protein molecules. They are now in the bloodstream and they fall on other T cells, soil them, so to speak, infect them, although there is not a big danger of infection, because infection, per definition, would be the injection of core to core.
So they become disguised, in other words.
Yes, and so you have basically healthy T cells covered with GP120, which is part of a virus, of the virus envelope. There are the immune system. Part of the immune system identifies, though, these T cells that are just covered by viral trash. I call it in the book. As the virus itself. Basically, basically T8 cells, or natural killer cells, we call them, think that it sounds a little bit strange, it is, so to speak, a viral misunderstanding. They think it is a virus, and they attack these T cells and destroy them. We have here a case of autoimmunity. And that is one of the problems, is autoimmunity. The other reason why that can happen is, for instance, let us take a cell that is covered with GP120, which is the protein molecule of the HIV virus. This T cell can fuse, let's say there is a T cell covered with this stuff. The T cell itself is basically still functioning, but it can fuse with other T cells, and the CD4 plus receptor, or the the CD4 plus molecule on top of the T cell locks in with a GP120 of the HIV virus, and they cause a fusion, call it syncytia, a giant cell. The same process can happen. Let's say you have one infected T cell that expresses RNA virus, the third step, so to speak. Then you have on the surface of the T cell GP120. That means the virus has replicated inside, it has passed the pro-viral phase from DNA, it has reversed again to RNA. The protein molecule GP120 is on the surface of that T cell. That T cell is now a huge virus. And it fuses with other T cells. Why? Because these T cells have on their surface CD4+. And they fit both together perfectly. We have GP120 like an open hand, I would say, if you would say it, on the HIV virus. And you have CD4+ like a closed fist. They fit. They come together. And the interchange of free particles of GP120 causes, though the core must not be always present, it is somewhere in one T cell, but these free particles can cause fusions plus an attack of autoimmunity. And it is a misunderstanding from the natural killer cells. They kill T cells that are covered with HIV viral trash from the coat.
Right.
That is something that I'm amazed that this is not mentioned anywhere, or that few doctors are mentioning that. I mean, there are some NDs, they are saying that. I don't know why they don't interfere in that process. You see, if you would not talking about a cure, if you would prevent that viral misunderstanding, indeed, Dr. Duisberg would be right. Then, because then you would have HIV, a couple of T cells would be infected, and if the natural killer cells or the rest of the immune system would get the information, hey, leave them alone, you know, nothing wrong, basically nothing would happen, or at least not this huge acquired immune deficiency syndrome.
Right. And Duisberg has also said that if HIV attacked the thymus, there would be a large concentration of it somewhere in the thymus, mm-hmm. and that is not what's happening. How do you answer this question?
First of all, let me say something. Dr. Duisberg is not an MD. Neither am I. I don't know. Many people don't know that. He is a PhD. He is a professor of microbiology, Berkeley, California, and he is indeed, he is an authority in retrovirology, for instance, in avian species and so forth. He has never, as far as I know, investigated in a pathological disease concerning humans. He's not an MD, but I'm not an MD either, so we meet here on the same level. Now, what was the question again?
That Duisberg said that the thymus does not show any concentration of HIV.
Dr. Duisberg refers here to Jacob Henley and Robert Koch postulate. Koch postulate requires that there is a virus in the diseased tissue, a microbe in the diseased tissue. To this, I want to say that Koch postulates are not... have been discarded long ago. Not many scientists teach today Koch postulate. They are not always accurate. The reason why you can have a disease in a tissue but a virus not present is the following. In other words, you can have the thymus gland, in your case now, you mentioned the thymus gland as the seat of immunity, the same way I could mention the large bones here, which are also storing immune system, T cell, B cell, and so forth. This is why we see often in the case of HIV that you have dots at the legs. So the big bones are storages for the immune system of immunity. So it must not always be the thymus gland. But let's take now this example. The reason for that is that the HIV virus can act on distance. This is something many people might not have yet heard. I give an example with diphtheria, which Robert Koch himself discovered. The patient had diphtheria, the microbe in the throat, but diphtheria is disease of the brain also. The disease was in the brain. So the microbe was not present in the tissue. It was here. How could that happen? Today we know that with powerful molecules, or it is maybe not that much known, but called lymphokines or cytokines, it is possible to release a neurotoxin. In other words, what happened with diphtheria was that the microbe was here, released a neurotoxin that worked its way to the neurons, which are the brain cells that are responsible for the thought process, or to the microglial cells, which are the cells that are basically that consist of the basic structure of the brain. So you have the virus here, the disease there. In the same way, the HIV virus contains a protein molecule. It's called NEF, N-E-F. That little sucker can work on distance. It can induce disease in another location. For instance, you can have the HIV virus in the abdominal region, and you can die of brain rot. You find HIV virus, or you don't find HIV virus in the neurons. This is what Dr. Duisberg says. He says, well, it doesn't infect brain cells. First of all, I have results here from my researchers that show HIV virus in microglial cells, which are, to say, precursor cells to the brain cells itself. But it is true in neurons, no HIV virus. But what you find is in a toxicological or a neurotoxin reaction from that protein NEF. And that causes, for instance, releases toxins that influence then these neurons or brain cells. In other words, the HIV virus can act and does act on distance.
So that is what they call dementia in AIDS?
Dementia, brain rot. By what is it caused? Dr. Gallo says that HIV virus comes from the monkeys. But there are many reasons why that is not possible. But one reason why how we see that HIV virus comes partly from sheep is the sheep virus itself is causes scrapie in sheep, neurological disease. Lentiretrovirus, long term, takes a while. That is the sheep part that causes the can cause brain rot, and you can die of brain rot before you even have one T cell destroyed.
Right. In fact, the first person to die in the New York hepatitis B trials died of brain rot, according to your book, without any immunosuppression or other.
Was not identified immediately. I say, for instance, Jill Brenner died of AIDS. That's what I say. They said he died of brain cancer. No, I say that was I have. Material about that, but this can happen that the virus goes into a macrophage, for instance, and this macrophage.
What is a macrophage?
A macrophage is also an antibody. The moment the virus enters you, macrophage is like a little Pac-Man. You know, the moment HIV virus enters you, macrophage comes from two sides and flops around the virus, and is now responsible to process the virus and to present him to the immune system. Unfortunately, this virus is man-made.
Presented for destruction.
For destruction, to the immune system. But, you know, the purpose of the macrophage is to chop up any enemy. It cannot chop up the AIDS virus. And you have now, in the macrophage, And I mentioned the macrophage only because the virus, you can be HIV positive up to the roof and you will test negative because you
it
have
hides within,
it hides
but
in the macrophage.
Why can it not destroy it?
Because it doesn't know this. It is this is a man-made thing. If the virus, and normally a macrophage is able to cut, to chop up via enzymes a virus and to present it on its surface to the immune system. And then, you know, to the, now you have here the problem. You see, when you're, and this is also why vaccination doesn't work, you have, so to speak, an inducing of antibodies, and you have in the macrophage, now in this little Trojan horse, in this little chamber or submarine, as I call it, you have the HIV virus and antibody. Now, you see, the problem is this. Unable to chop up the HIV virus because it is not used to this structure. The HIV virus per se does not exist in nature. It exists only because it's man-made. It is an artifact, as we say. Unable to chop up the HIV virus. Now remember, in the macrophage is HIV and antibody, right? So unable to chop up the HIV virus to destroy it, it destroys the antibody. And the macrophage destroys the antibody, and the virus continues living and even replicating in the macrophage. And this macrophage is now floating through your system, can pass the blood
barrier.
Then it can enter the brain, and there it causes this disease. But it can also be that you have sex with somebody and you pass on your macrophages to the person. And now it opens in the person. HIV positive. Now it comes to you
the
and
say...
The
cell wall breaks open and the virus spills out.
Virus breaks loose and does its work. Not much devastating work, I agree with Dr. Duisberg, but the immune system doesn't know. It sees all that stuff, all that viral treasure on the T cells, on the B cells, and it attacks itself. This is the problem of the macrophage.
Well, while we're on the subject of the macrophage, what is the macrophage test for AIDS? I know there is the ELISA and the Western blot, but apparently the Army switched sometime around 1992 the macrophage test for military personnel.
They better.
how does it differ? And
microbial probing. You could... via microbial probing, you can identify if a macrophage is filled with HIV or not. For instance, a normal macrophage would be something, as I told you, that destroys the virus and presents it. So a dysfunction of macrophages, you would actually analyze a you would take the blood or serum and you would analyze the macrophages and you would open them. You know, you would actually see if they are functioning in the right way. So you have to indeed look at the macrophages.
And that is why there are all these false positives or negatives with the other tests.
And another reason, and this is the greatest problem, 9,000 to the power of 4. This is how much the HIV virus, the AIDS virus, can recombinate. This is 6,561 trillion possibilities. I say now also in my book that very soon, maybe already, the HIV virus has changed its structure. Sometimes it can change it by just taking away one surface protein molecule, and it's something else. Suddenly the immune system doesn't recognize it anymore as such or as something else and has to change the strategy. But it is even worse. The virus changes so much that you will not be able to identify him anymore as HIV. It will be something completely different, causing a different disease. This is the main problem. They might say, oh, HIV goes back and wonderful, no more AIDS and this and that. But the problem is that some other diseases will come up. They will invent some fancy names and will not know that the same virus is causing that. It just changed from a pistol to a machine gun somehow into another weapon. This virus will not go away because he survives. It survives, you could say. It rearranges itself. And that is, and this is why I say it's important to read the book that I wrote, because this is not just a fictive story. I got a call from Dr. Halstead, who is, I mean, I have here his credentials. These are all MDs who corroborate what I write. The only thing in which they do not always agree is that Dr. Shmunis did not know anything about this. Now, my researchers, since I'm from Europe and so forth, I had possibilities to research in his life, to see his videos, to see him speaking on video, and also to read his works. He didn't know about that. He was just a dupe, so to speak. He was used for that.
Well, didn't he want half of the men to have sexual relations with the other people in the trial to see what the transmissibility factor was? I got that feeling that...
Yeah.
So that would seem to suggest that...
You mean a double-blinded experiment. 50% of the men received, in his hepatitis B vaccine trial, of 1,083 men received the vaccine, the hepatitis B vaccine, 50% a placebo. This is required for a double-blind experiment, as shaky and as doubtful these results and these double-blind experiments might be. What he wanted to, why he chose sexually promiscuous young men was only one reason, not because he wanted to give them AIDS, as even some MDs think, or because he hated gays and blacks. He vaccinated against hepatitis B. 2 in 3 gay men have hepatitis B. Higher percentage than heterosexuals. So, he chose promiscuous men because he wanted to make sure that they came in touch with hepatitis B.
Right.
Because, you know, they would have sex with other homosexuals, and and they would, it's almost sure that you come in contact with somebody that has hepatitis B. Thus, you can test the vaccine because they will
see
get the virus.
See if it's working.
See if it's working. And so, I present in my book just the fact that they must have used his vaccinations like the government is using anything. I mean, it's even now on Montel Williams. I saw it 2 days ago, what I was writing years ago in my book. 2 days ago on Montel Williams, he worked for the Air Force. He's a lieutenant for the Air Force, or was one. He said, well, what's going on here? The government is... we are the guinea pigs of the government. Yeah, but this plutonium radiation thing is just the tip of the iceberg. You cannot understand the plutonium experiments also in connection with the Russian government, which is involved in that whole AIDS thing, if you don't read the book The Man Who Created AIDS, because I present in this book with Ovchinnikov and Litvinov and the others the Russia connection that is not known here in this country. And that took me quite a while to find that out, that the Russian and the American government, and also the European governments, so to speak, the German and the French, they're basically homophobic, white, racist, supremacist governments. I mean, it was not allowed in the Soviet Union, until it was the Soviet Union, for black people to immigrate. There were no blacks in Russia, you know. So this whole thing is, what I prove in this book is simply that. Those who rule you hate you. You are the guinea pigs. They need desperately the human experiment, because you cannot go just and ask a group of people, would you participate in this dangerous experiment? They need it, A, for trying out their viruses, if they find a cure against them, B, to test their biowarfare stuff. You know, how does a virus or a radiation work on 1 million, 2 million, 3 million people? Well, I can't go to the enemy, so I use my own people. And in case of danger, I augment the dose, then I know what happens.
Well, while we're on this subject, I'd like to ask you this question. In 1985, in February, Clad Stevens and Gallo said in a letter published in the New England Journal of Medicine that the New York hepatitis B vaccine and placebo recipients both tested HIV positive at 40%.
Correct.
Therefore, they reasoned that the vaccine was as harmless as the placebo. Why were they incorrect in this assumption?
They are correct. Let me say something to Clad Stevens. In 1982, she in her retrospective studies she and I presented in the book, she said that one man in the hepatitis B vaccine trial had AIDS. In 83, she mentioned one in three men. In 86, in her WHO and CDC report, she said the majority of the gay men from the Shmunis trial have AIDS. You see what you can do with statistics. Now, interesting enough, my research has discovered that even more placebo men had the virus than vaccine men. Now, the reason for that is a retrospective prospective cancer experiment suggested by Dr. Philip Kohl at WHO. He suggests to have people that are first healthy, as a theoretical suggestion, of course. He emphasizes that word, but he suggests the human cancer experiment as the people are first healthy to find a cure for cancer, because 50% of scientists think that cancer is caused by a virus, but you have no experimental group. How can you prove it? So he suggests people are first healthy, then they get the virus, then they have close contact with others. What is the closest contact that you can have physically?
Sex.
Of course. Then, exitus. And all the time you take their blood and follow them, and then you can see what does a cancer virus do to humans. How does a virus cause cancer? Since the other approach of finding a cure for cancer obviously didn't work, we have nowadays 600,000 people dying every year. That's a minute. Every minute one person dies of cancer. I mean, so now they had this other approach. Could cancer be not just a some flaw of a gene, but caused by a virus? And so, Dr. Shmonis' hepatitis B vaccine trial was the perfect human cancer experiment. Because the gay men were first healthy.
Well, then, may I interrupt you there for a moment? Because as you probably know, Duisberg and Rappaport both say that that was absolutely not true, that they were already immunosuppressed because of high promiscuity and drugs, poppers, etc. So
pre-1978 blood. The hepatitis B vaccine trials, as you might recall, began in October, in November 1978, and ended in October 79. Pre-1978 blood was HIV negative. Post-1978 blood was HIV positive. That indicates that it must have been put into the vials of the hepatitis B vaccine trial. And in both vials, not in all of them. In some of the vaccine group and some of the placebo group. Why not in all of them? That would not be the perfect cancer experiment. We are talking here human experiment, like with radiation and plutonium, and so you cannot indiscriminately infect everybody because that would disturb the objective. The objective is first, is it infectious? That would mean I would have to inject it into you. B, is it contagious? That would mean there must be some healthy ones with whom you, who for that example now has the virus, would come together. This is why they didn't give to all the gay men the virus, but only to some of them. And then they knew which numbers had the virus and not. And then they would see who is the group that has the original virus and who is infected. How does that work? And you see, the thing is this. The experiment continues. Everybody who has AIDS is now coming to the doctor and says, please continue with the experiment. I have cancer, because that's what they also have. Cancer, you know, KS and so forth. Not all of them. So the experiment goes on, and the data flow in and pour in, and it is just, I mean, it's heaven for any cancer researcher. Not only did they create the disease, now they see, they try to find a cure on that approach. B, it is a perfect biowarfare experiment, of course. I mean, you see.
Well, I thought the implication, or one possible implication, of their both being 40% positive could have been that the placebo itself was also tainted.
Oh, yes. As I said, both vials, which by the way had only numbers, they were only there were no names. You know, it was a double-blind experiment where nobody from the staff, also not Dr. Smunders, knew who got the vaccine, who got the placebo. Two people knew, Professor Krugman and McCollum, both pioneers of hepatitis B and world-renowned authorities. They knew who got the vaccine, who got the placebo. And so some of the placebo got the virus in the vials and some of the vaccine group. So I don't see any contradiction in what Dr. Duisberg is saying there. You know, he's right. There were, I mean, I don't know now what is his objection to that. Maybe you could read me again so I see there's some question in that, but I saw it more as a statement, his statement to the placebo group. What was he meaning by that?
Well, you already covered the essential point when you described the autoimmune process as the reason for the destruction of so many T cells by something other than the virus. But let me read the explanation from your book on page 193, and I quote, "What destroyed the T4 cells if not the HIV virus? It took me almost a month and hundreds of hours at the electron microscope to solve the riddle. Viral envelopes, GP120, from degrading HIV virus can and do bind to uninfected T4 lymphocytes, or rather to their surface molecule CD4. This causes the appearance of antibodies in the HIV-infected person. These antibodies, together with killer T cells, identify the HIV envelope soiled T4 cells as enemies and attack and destroy them. That is the explanation to why T cells in an HIV-infected person are so dramatically affected, although only a small number of them are actually destroyed by the AIDS virus. According to the CDC's surveillance definition for AIDS,
yes,
a person can be diagnosed as an AIDS case by having any one or more of 15 or 20 so indicator diseases, as they call them, in the presence of a positive test for HIV antibodies, which seems to turn the whole science of virology on its head.
You know, it's so interesting, like with the Navajo flu, with all these things. For a while you heard all these things, the virus and the Indians, by the way, healthy young men. Who were the people of the hepatitis B vaccine trial? Healthy young men, because soldiers are healthy and soldiers are young. You know what I mean? And when
those men in New York were
young and
soldiers?
Healthy. No, I mean, so good question. I say soldiers are healthy and young. In case of a war, you deal with soldiers, right? So you will always look for a group of healthy young men with whom you make the experiment. And you see, and when the experiment is over, although I said right now it is continuing, yeah, it's running out, it is continuing, but the core of the experiment is over. What the government then does is it so to speak hogwashes it. It sort of dilutes it, and gives information that seems contradictive, so that the people are, I think, in a way, Dr. Duisberg might work in that sense for the government as a disinformation expert, so that people think, HIV doesn't cause AIDS. Oh, maybe it was something else. Thank you very much. And then they look in another direction while the experiment continues to a certain extent, but the main data are there and the government doesn't need it anymore. You see, if the people would concentrate now on HIV causes AIDS and so forth, it would keep the concentration on AIDS. But so they could say, it doesn't cause it. Aha, something else causes it. And your concentration, our concentration, our thoughts are taken away from the man-made origin of it, as it was done with the Navajo flu that I say was just another cancer experiment, biowarfare experiment in young men. After a while, you don't hear anything anymore. And I tell you something, the government or those who are responsible for this human experiment welcome any distracting theory.
Sure.
And amazing, and unfortunately, people like Rappaport, who wrote for the Stern and everything, I mean, which is a reputed magazine. I myself am in the Stern of the last week with two pages, so I know that is a world-renowned magazine, and it is unfortunate that Mr. Rappaport is, so to speak, so fascinated is the right word. Because Mr. Rappaport was first of the same opinion of Dr. Alan Cantwell Jr. As you recall, he writes the introduction to his book, AIDS and the Doctors of Death. But suddenly he turns around, he becomes, so to speak, a backstabber. And now he listens to Dr. Duisberg, who says HIV doesn't cause AIDS. This is almost like verbal killing. I say this is like verbal manslaughter or it's dangerous. You see, because as I said in the beginning, the people who are listening and say HIV doesn't cause AIDS, they say, "Oh, thank you, let's have sex." You know. We have really to, in order to understand fully, the people have to read the book, The Man Who Created AIDS, and then they will understand that it's sheep and cattle, and it changes its structure. And soon it will be something else, and you cannot detect it anymore.
Yes, HIV, HTLV3, all of these abbreviations, I would like you perhaps to explain how AIDS came to be called HIV when AIDS-related viruses were originally, by Gallo, I believe, called HTLV1, which implied that there was leukemia involved, and they wanted to sanitize the name and all these things. And bovine visnavirus, which Dr. Strecker said, he thought, well, it looks like bovine virus combined with visnavirus, and he put a Medline search in for that, which he had simply thought of, and all these references came out for that very title.
I go even further and say that HTLV1 and HTLV2, as named by Dr. Gallo, that these viruses, he calls them human T-cell leukemia virus, number one. Which is causing leukemia of the blood. Human T-cell leukemia virus number two, which causes hairy cell leukemia. It's sort of a circle with a dot in it and some, you know, hairs
syncytial.
Syncytium. Bovine syncytium.
Foaming.
Virus, yes. You know, Dr. Gallo, he comes suddenly up with two viruses, HTLV1, HTLV2. The question must be allowed, where do they come from? Dr. Gallo, according to Dr. Gallo, they are human. They come, well, for H you could think homosexual, you know. But maybe that is a suggestion. But I want to know, where do they come from? My research has showed, and I described that in the book, that if you look in a cow, you see a virus that has the same molecular weight, the same magnesium dependency, same purple bending, same
morphology,
which is the shape, same everything. Everybody is talking about Henle Koch postulate that they must be fulfilled. Well, then let's take one of Koch postulates. If two viruses look alike and they are that, and they have all these common characteristics, then they must be the same. Now, then, Dr. Gallo, now, clever as he is, I say he is involved in the whole AIDS thing. I say he is involved in the creation of the AIDS virus. But I tell you something. Now, Dr. Gallo says, HTLV1 cannot come from the cow. And he now, who doesn't like Koch postulates himself, catches, you see how you can play with the mind. He says, well, inject the virus in the cow and see if the cow becomes sick. According to Koch postulate, the cow would have to become sick so that you can prove it comes from the cow. Indeed, when you take HTLV1 and you inject it in the cow doesn't blink, makes moo, and gives some milk.
Because of the species barrier?
No. Because of something else. Because of what happened with the HIV virus, and this is the same. They took the virus from the cow, bovine leukemia virus, and they put it, you can re-dramatize this experiment at any school and university, they put it into the human tissue culture. And out came a virus that would not infect any more the cows, but only
humans.
Of course. Now, if you
but
take
not by itself, they combined it with the bovine virus, correct, in the human
they tissue. Took the bovine leukemia virus, put it in cancerous human tissue culture, and what happens through that seeding process, of course there are also other ways to do it,
or
but through the
serial passage.
Serial passage, this is the process of serial passage, what comes out is a virus that now has become human because it is tainted by the human gene and all that. And it doesn't cause any more disease in cows, but only in humans. And that is the reason why when you re-inject it in the cow does nothing. This experiment, I quote in my book, has been already done by a python ruse with a mice virus. They injected, they put virus from who caused disease in mice through human tissue culture and injected it back into a mice, into a mouse, doesn't cause disease anymore. So that is the reason why HTLV-1 and HTLV-2 are not human viruses, but are viruses from a cow put by somebody, by whom, well, we'll find out, into human tissue culture and then into people. For instance, into black people during the smallpox vaccinations.
In Africa.
In Africa.
Welcome back to Contemporary Communications Conference. We have Christian Anders, also known as Lanou, performer and writer of the play, video, and book, The Man Who Created AIDS. He often performs the play at Phoenix Bookstore in Santa Monica, where you can get the book, or you can call 1-800-359-3177. He is interviewed by Ned Potter, independent AIDS researcher, on the subject, AIDS as a bioweapon. Ned will continue with this introduction.
International Center Proceedings No. 15, published in the Fogarty Federation Proceedings, Volume 31, No. 3, May-June 1972, reports the proceedings of a workshop held at the National Institute of Health, Bethesda, Maryland, July 27 through 30, 1970. The committee for the conference was sponsored by the John E. Fogarty International Center for Advanced Study in Health Sciences and the World Health Organization. At that conference, in a histocompatibility workshop, D.B. Amos of Duke University, with other allegedly independent scientists and bureaucrats, who in fact were and are dependent upon United States government grants to further their research, suggested at page 1102, and I quote, "In relation to the immune response, a number of useful experimental approaches can be visualized. One would be a study of the relationship of human leukemia A type to the immune response, both humoral and cellular, to well-defined bacteria and viral antigens during preventive vaccinations. This approach would be particularly informative when applied to SIBSHIPs." And on this issue, Dr. Strecker remarks in his report, Bioattack Alert, and I quote, "I assume by well-defined they meant well-known. I further assume that by SIBSHIPs they meant children of the same parents. Therefore, it is clear that the World Health Organization and the National Institutes of Health decided in 1970 to inject known virus and bacteria into children of the same parents during allegedly preventive vaccinations to study human leukemia A type. Then in 1972, the WHO bulletin changed the study to a study of virus which causes a depression in immune function. I repeat, let there be no question that infection was intended, because a part of the study was to be the time relationship between infection and antigen administration." Lanou, do you think that vaccinations are an effective disease control method?
I say, and I'm not alone with that, I want to point out here that nothing that I say in the book is only my opinion, but it is corroborated by world-renowned physicians. And I say, but I say something now that sounds revolutionary, but it is time now to get this message out. The experiment continues. Immunizations of any kind and vaccinations are, in my opinion, and also in the opinion of many MDs, nothing short of scientific fraud. Immunization, in the long run, I say, even causes disease. Diseases such as neurological diseases, brain cancer, other cancers, all these fancy new names they are coming up now with, are basically effects of a cause called vaccination. All I can say is, mothers, don't immunize your children. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, they want to vaccinate and immunize everybody. I just say, with, for instance, Dr. Campbell Douglas Jr., Doctor of the Year, National Health Federation, who says immunization and vaccination is a crime against humanity, absolutely unaffected. I repeat with Professor Creighton, Encyclopedia Britannica, and with others, that if you are vaccinated, you have basically, what it is you want to induce an antibody reaction, an immune reaction to an antigen, to a foreign molecule, which is injected into the bloodstream, into the body. What you basically do is you put a diseased particle into a previously healthy human being. It makes me shiver, and my stomach is cramping when I see on TV these innocent poor little children that they inject, that are immunized. It is a crime. It will cause cancer sooner or later, and it will not prevent disease, because I prove in my book, The Man Who Created AIDS, I present statistics and numbers. For instance, that if you take a group of people that have been vaccinated against smallpox or any other disease, that the occurrence of smallpox in the group that has been vaccinated is often bigger or in a higher amount than in those who have not been vaccinated. All these data I present here, I say it again, vaccination is ineffective, although it creates indeed a certain immune response. But that immune response is to the antigen that is injected and not to the disease itself. All you have to do is to read the book and to see, for instance, another crime that I have to point out here is measles. Now, there was an occurrence of pregnant, this was in the Outlook headline. Pregnant mothers who have been vaccinated against measles give birth to children that are prone to measles. Now, what is happening here? This was one day on the headline, whoops, it was away. What is happening is very simple. Many people don't know that. When you are vaccinated, you react with antibodies. But you react with a little lower or less antibody than if you would have got the real disease. For instance, if I vaccinate you against hepatitis B, the body knows, it's just a sort of faked virus, since the vaccine is made of the virus, although today there are other approaches. So, the mother has been vaccinated against measles. It reacts with a lower output of antibody. This reaction is passed on to the child. The child's immune system knows now, when you get measles, you react with a certain amount. That amount is too low, because it is to the vaccine itself. When the child is now born, the measles virus comes, a normal virus, from the air, from the surrounding, from everywhere. The child, following what it has learned in the mother's womb, namely to react with a certain amount, reacts with too low amount of antibody against measles, and gets measles. And you know what the answer of the doctors is now? They say, maybe we should vaccinate the children even more. I say it's a crime. I say don't vaccinate your children. Don't go yourself to immunization or vaccination. It'll cause disease.
And perhaps you could also mention the childhood leukemia statistics and how they probably are a result of the polio vaccinations, those vaccines cultured in, of all things, green monkey kidney tissue, which may have allowed another virus to become part of the vaccine.
Salk and Sabin, by injection and by swallowing, you have both approaches for polio vaccinations. The problem with polio is not so much also they stopped the polio vaccinations because children died with cancer and neurological disease, and so they...
Leukemia was the major result, wasn't it?
Leukemia, there was also brain cancer and brain disease, neurological diseases. The problem is, with all vaccinations, is according to, for instance, Campbell Douglas Jr., MD, for instance, to Professor Creighton, MD, and so forth, I could go on, is that the incubation period is 10, 20, 30, sometimes 40 years.
Years.
It is, you have a little time bomb when you have a vaccination. It is a foreign particle, and it can open like a macrophage, to give an example. It can open sooner, it can open later, and then it causes what they say cancer and all sorts of the Parkinson's disease. It's a fancy name after Mr. Parkinson. I say that these diseases are basically caused by vaccinations. And as I predicted in my book before they talked about plutonium and all that stuff, I mentioned the Russia connection already in my book long ago. I predict something else here on the radio. I predict a flood of lawsuits of parents and children and grandchildren against the vaccination companies, Merck and companies, Squibb, Lipton, Abbott, Pfizer, I could go on, Geiger, E.B. Geiger, and so and this lawsuits will have as an accusation, your vaccinations have caused cancer in me, in my children, in my grandchildren, and so forth. This is a time where everything comes out of the closet. We have something ahead of us.
Is AIDS a sexually transmitted disease?
No. Because what is a sexually transmitted disease per definition? It has to be, for instance, in the venereal tract. Now, is the HIV virus in the venereal tract? Yeah. You know, it is in the blood system, in the lymphatic system, in the macrophages, in under the skin. Other danger for the macrophages. You can have a scratch and you have it. I say now something. They can sneeze it on you. Now, I want to ask a question to our listeners. If I have hepatitis B, or I have a cold. Let's say I have a cold. Now I have sex with somebody. Now this person has a cold too. Is this a sexually transmitted disease?
You can get it in intimate
contact. So it does not, you see, it does not require all the conditions, the exact conditions of a sexually transmitted disease, as for instance syphilis or, other.
Which exists mainly in the tract.
Although syphilis, I might add, has a blood-borne phase. But AIDS per se is not... there are many examples, and I quote them in my book, where people had sex with HIV-positive persons, and they were not infected. I mean, we know that. There are people, they're married, and they had sex for 2 years until they even knew, and the wife is not infected. Which does not mean, of course, you see, we got to be careful now not to say the same than Dr. Duisberg, or Professor Duisberg, it's the correct approach, that HIV doesn't cause AIDS because it's not a sexually transmitted disease. Of course, you can get it through sex. Oh, yes, you can, but not necessarily.
Talk a little bit about the Rife Ray, which in your book you claim is the cure for AIDS as well as cancer and other diseases.
Yes. Everything has its mortal oscillatory rate. We know that, we have that experience now during the 6.6?
6.6.
I was in Europe during that time. I just came back. We have experienced with the earthquake the cure for AIDS and cancer, for any virological disease, as strange as this might sound. Why? The 6.6 had a certain vibration frequency that was on the same level with certain houses, with certain structures, with others not. This is why some houses are standing, some are not standing. Why? Because at that point, for instance, there are three houses in a row. The middle one is destroyed. The one to the left is standing, the one to the right is standing. You could say it's a 6.6. Why are they not all gone? MOR. The mortal oscillatory rate, or the special frequency in which the structure of the house was built, was reached for the house in the middle to fall apart. Not for the house to the left, not for the house to the right. Take a glass, for instance. You have a glass, you sing a certain tune, or you apply a certain vibration, and when you reach the same frequency than the glass is built on, it will shatter. That is what Raymond Royal Rife did. I describe it in detail. What he was able to do, and this is, I mean, we could talk now hours about this, it is an outrage. how these findings were suppressed by the government. Why? Because then the cutting and the surgery and the drugs came up. They make a lot of more money as if you have cancer, I put you under the on the table and I radiate you once every 3 days, and after a couple of times you are healthy, and then no more business. While we have nowadays $100 billion per year in cancer research, that's where the big money is. You are only of interest for them when you are sick, not when you are healthy. That is the sad truth. What Raymond Roy Rive did was so incredible, even leaving aside his model oscillatory rate thing. He had invented a microscope where he could see the virus alive. Now, ask somebody, anybody nowadays, even the e-microscope or other approaches, they don't see the virus alive, basically. They have to stain it, acid fast, and so forth. They look at the corpse. It's dead.
Exactly.
And now they want to find a cure by looking at dead viruses, almost as if you would be dead, and I would say, now I want to treat him. You're dead.
In other words, the pleomorphic aspect of microorganisms is totally below the...
Pleomorphism means to change form. This is now, you mentioned a revolutionary word, because most of scientists still don't believe in pleomorphism. They think here's a virus and there's a bacteria, but pleomorphism says it's constantly changing. A virus is a pre-bacterial state, and the bacteria is a post-viral state. And there we come suddenly to... So, Raymond, pleomorphicity, we could have another show about that, but to stay with it now, when you look... He was able to see the virus alive. Then he determined via reflection, microscopy.
Yes.
I'm from Germany. I have always difficulty with the English. I apologize. I have problems with the English language. He discovered the frequency of the virus. For instance, 2,000 hertz, 400 angstrom.
Each one having its own particular...
I described them all. Every virus has its own frequency. All you have to do is to punch it in the computer. Everybody, for instance, if I would treat somebody, I would take this man, if I would be an MD, I would take him, take his blood, identify his special virus, and then radiate him, electromagnetic vibrations and so forth, with the same frequency. What Raymond Roy Rive saw under the microscope was the same that they see now in Berkeley. They are experimenting already with it.
They have the equipment now again?
Yeah, I say they had it always, but, that is a thing that doesn't bring you any money because it's a cure. They're not interested in a cure. So what he did is he saw the frequency of the virus, then he radiated it in the tissue culture, and the virus literally fell apart, had to fall apart. And he did that individually, as you said, with every patient differently, of course, because everybody has a different frequency. So you see now the approach with AZT or with drugs, or so it's like shooting with a pistol at mosquitoes. You might hit one or two, you know what I mean? But it is you have to make a treatment individually for each patient. And this is what Raymond Roy Rive did, and indeed he cured cancer. There is no difference, I say that now, between a cold and between AIDS. There is no difference. If you find the cure for a cold, you have found the cure for cancer. You have found the cure for AIDS, because they all are virological diseases. And of course you have then not only to kill the virus, but you have to do parallel measurements like dietary. You cannot go on living as you did, you know what I mean? And just destroy the virus, because, and now comes the most important thing. You see, these virologists like Dr. Gallo and so, they think we are stupid. They think basically you are the goyim, you are the cattle, you are the, you know nothing. They said, I found a new virus. Let me tell you something, Dr. Gallo, in case you're listening now. In the female uterus, there are zillions of viruses. Now you come up here and say, I found a new virus. Yeah, what is this? Whom do you want to fool? All viruses that are there already, it depends when your immune system is down. They attack.
Except in the case of retroviruses, correct me if I'm wrong, is it not true that most retroviruses are not toxic, not destructive to humans, and that only...
Correct. And why is that so? Because we are talking here about two kinds of retroviruses. We are talking about one kind of retrovirus that is appearing in nature, in mice, in chicken, in avian species, but That is correct, and Dr. Duisberg is correct with that. But HIV is not a retrovirus appearing in nature. It is an animal retrovirus made human. That makes all the difference.
But it did appear in nature in the bovine
right.
species.
You have it sometimes in cows, sheep, cattle virus. I mean, that's an old virological shoe. I'm not saying something new here. Experiments with sheep, and I present in my book here, experiments with sheep and cattle virus in human tissue culture are since 1951, since we have HeLa cells, you know. And Dr. Gallo, whom I openly call a liar, and I challenge him on any discussion to prove that AIDS is man-made and that he was involved in it. Dr. Gallo says...
To disprove that AIDS is man-made.
Right. Yeah. Well, he says that AIDS is
not.
That AIDS is not man-made, but, you know... what did I want to say now? About the... I forgot where we were. I got so excited of Dr. Gallo. Because this guy... This man, I mean, if there is any reincarnation, if reincarnation is true, he will come back as a victim, believe me. Because I say that he was involved in the creation of AIDS.
If AIDS is in fact a bioweapon
yeah.
and an insidious tool of repression, would you in good conscience be able to favor mandatory testing for all people?
Oh, there we come to it. A delicate thing. I mean, who am I to suggest anything? I just say they can sneeze it on you. I say don't think you can get AIDS only from sex, like they're lying to you. You can only get it when you have sex or through needles. What a nonsense. I say the virus is getting stronger and stronger. I say the experiment might be over for the government, so they whitewash you, so they hogwash you, they allow people like Duisberg and so to say even HIV is not caused by AIDS because so it takes your attention away to something else. But mandatory testing, how far can we get into the private life of people? But, you know, what if it would be a plague, you see? Like, if it is as dangerous as I say it is, I would say, you know, it's
yes.
almost necessary.
But, of course, we agree that naturally occurring plagues, in that case, it would be necessary, and it's been done, isolation,
yeah.
quarantining, and all. But if it is, in fact, an intentional weapon of repression, then aren't we morally obligated to resist mandatory testing?
We are first obligated to ask who did it, who was involved in it. There has to be a public criminal investigation via Congress, the companies that were involved who conducted the experiment, not only plutonium and this, but are we all the guinea pigs? I guess there has to be an independent consortium built of judges and doctors and lawyers and what do I know, and they have to find out is it really true, not only with AIDS. But obviously that the government, since always, is using its own people as guinea pigs.
Right, but
if
in this case
so,
it's contagious, so that is very different from a plutonium experiment, for example.
Yeah, and what about fluoride in the water? You know, I mean, they use not only that, they put it in the yellow cornflakes, they put it here and there. What else do they do? If they do that, what are they able to do? You might be Dr. Strecker, ask, well, no, we shouldn't just go on. Or ask now people like Dr. Gallo, could you please make an investigation who created AIDS? You might ask the same people that created the disease to help you finding a cure. I say in my book that this is the book that will cause a world revolution. Because you see, where will you begin? Whom should we ask? Well, if the government is involved in it, as Montel Williams even said on the show, you think the government... Yeah, whom do you ask, the government? I don't think so.
Think back to all the Tony Brown shows back in 87 and 88 and all, when he had on Dr. Strecker and Dr. Cantlow and all those people, and now he's completely changed his lineup.
Tony Brown called me 5 days ago. He ordered the book and the video. They want to take me on the Tony Brown Journal. I know that Tony Brown is... this was suggested by Professor Felder, who teaches at the New York University. I mean, I come on the show, but I guess more and more people are now aware. It's, you know, for some people who read my book said, Lanou, I simply can't believe it. Because whom can you trust then? These are the same people that I elected as president. And you say that they are doing this with us. What next? Yeah, what next? French Revolution? you know, and to answer you with isolation and sanitation. Yeah, for many plagues, the only cure was take care of
control,
the plague, was isolation and sanitation, and it went away. With smallpox, the same. Smallpox, the power of smallpox with Cortes and the Incas is so interesting. I mean, we could have another show about that. Who really won the war? Why Cortes, with a handful of people, was able to take Mexico? Mm-hmm. Why? Because he didn't die from smallpox and they did. I mean, this is now a little sidetrack. But what can we do? We have to inform ourselves first. This is why I wrote the book. You have to take your life in your own hand. You can trust almost nobody anymore. That's the plain truth. What can I say?
Lanou, aside from the Rife therapy, are there other treatments for AIDS, cancer, and other diseases?
There are. And most of them have been oppressed because they work. The government and the CDC is not interested in you being cured. First of all, they are interested in the human experiment. That has to be done properly. That means people have to be infected, they have to die, and all the time they have to take their blood and they have to have the data. Other than that, they are interested that you stay sick, because when you stay sick, you are subject to research and you can have chemotherapy, treatments, drugs, surgery, cutting, and so forth. That makes a lot of money, $100 billion per year. But there are, and I present in my book, The Man Who Created AIDS, testimony of 6 independent doctors, MDs, who reversed 300 AIDS patients from HIV positive to HIV negative. One of the things that is really working, and I had somebody on my TV show, Ed McCabe, who proves that ozone, I mean, I knew that from 20 years ago, because we in Europe have ozone treatment 20 years since always, that ozone is very helpful with against AIDS. Why? Because the HIV virus is anaerobic, it cannot live on oxygen, and so with this ozone oxygen treatment, you, so to speak, make it impossible for the HIV virus to replicate. This is one approach that is very effective. As to, for instance, ribavirin, something else, Prime Minister of Yugoslavia, former Prime Minister, he had a drug called, this is one of the few cases where a drug is effective, called ribavirin. Now that is a very effective, now finally, after it has been oppressed, it has been denied and so forth, finally the CDC accepts and the FDA that ribavirin is effective. It prolongs the state of health if somebody has HIV. It is not toxic. It is very strong and effective, and I present in my book 800 numbers. There are other treatments, for instance, photophoretic treatment. I have there an 800 number also. This is suggested by Campbell Douglas Jr. MD, where you take your own blood out or you irradiate it under ultraviolet light and so forth, and then you re-inject it. You can ozonize it also. You take it out, ozonize, and then re-inject it. There are so many approaches that all work, that for sure work more than AZT, of which now even the CDC and so forth admit that it doesn't work. Actually, they needed to give you AZT because they wanted to make sure that everybody really dies, or because that is part of the experiment. You are healthy, you get infected, and you die. Now, when you get AZT, they can make sure that you really die. Because some people have HIV. You see, Dr. Duisberg is not all wrong. He says, well, you have HIV and you cannot get AIDS. Well, you will get it. But you can be, for quite a while, you can be healthy. Now, to not allow you to stay at least healthy now that they gave you the virus, they give you AZT to make sure that you die. And you think it is a drug that helps you, but what it is, of course, it attacks the bone marrow and so forth and kills you. So AZT is just to attain the objective to make sure that you die. That is why you get it. I present other approaches in this book, DMSO, Krebiozane, one is fasting, of course, cancer. This is talking about cancer. Cancer is also when you are filled up with mucus and dirt and when you are toxic in the body. Mora is another therapy with the patient's own oscillations. Homeopathy is very antigens. There is another approach by Dr. Bertha LeCuspe, by the way, that was a great woman. She knew a lot. She was an MD, but they just laughed about her. Laetril, glyoxylide, the Revici treatment, detoxification, the Issel's cure. You see, there's a German doctor. I just see here in the book, his quota of cures was, wait a moment, I have the exact percentage, 16.6% cure rate among all the terminal patients treated. What is our percentage? Zero. This man was destroyed by Mathilde Krim, by Leska, by the other dragon ladies, by the FDA, by the CDC, by the EMA. It's unbelievable. This man who gave his life for others was put into jail, but he has 16.6% cure. I write about him here. Unbelievable. But I guess, this is the age of truth. But unfortunately, I must say, the people might be shocked. The truth might surpass their wildest thoughts of what really happens. Because some people are still in the illusion that those whom they have elected, that they will take care of them and that they are good people and that there's everything okay. No, I say right now the true criminals are not in jail. We are ruled by crooks and murderers.
Well, to go back to ozone for a moment, perhaps that could work with the blood if the virus were free in the blood, but what about it reaching into the macrophage or into the lymph system?
There's a point, you see. I mean, this is, I must say, I think immediately the ozone treatment should be allowed. I mean, there should be an uproar, because what they do is they try it themselves, and, the ozone, you have to be injected, you have to be intravenous and so on, something can happen. It has to immediately to be legalized. They talk about legalizing marijuana. They should rather talk about legalizing ozone. This is a good question. What does it do to the macrophage? How is the macrophage? I spoke with, I don't even know if I mentioned that with Ed McCabe. I don't know if that is so effective. I don't want to say things that I don't know. You know what I mean? How far can ozone get through the macrophage into the virus, or destroy the macrophage and then get to the virus? We would have to ask that question to Ed McCabe, who is an authority in ozone, and in my book I have his number and everything. So that would be an interesting question to find out. Where does ozone reach? At what stage? Mm. When you have AIDS already, is it then also effective? Or when you are HIV positive, which as you know is a different thing. Can be HIV positive and you're perfectly healthy. Mm. And then there is AIDS, the infection, AIDS, the disease, and so forth.
In his book, AIDS Incorporated, John Rappaport says that Professor Duisberg has maintained that one can be HIV positive and have no virus anywhere in the system. How do you answer this?
That's correct. That's correct. But we should, from that, not generalize that you are HIV positive, and you have no virus. I explain. A mother that is pregnant, that is HIV positive, a mother that has virus and antibody, I'm defining her now as HIV positive, she is pregnant, she has a child in her womb, in utero. She passes on now to the child. Now, this is important now. She passes on to the child antibodies, but no virus. That is possible and that happened. Now the child is born. Now the child is born with antibodies against HIV in the blood. Per definition, you would say it's HIV positive, but there's no virus. After passing on the information to the memory cells, maybe, since there is no HIV virus in this little child, the antibodies disappear again because they have nothing to do. So per definition, you would say it's miraculously cured from HIV since there's no more virus. The other thing is possible too, that the child gets a virus but no antibodies from the mother. Now, important, the child develops own antibodies. And when it's born, it has antibodies and virus, both from it, the virus from the mother, the antibodies from the child. Then it's HIV positive too. Now, the first example from Dr. Duisberg, it's very rare, but it could happen. Example, one man is HIV positive. He has sex with man or woman. Through a, but it is very rare, but he could pass on, since they are not always together, antibody and virus, he could pass on the antibody. But no
virus.
Virus. In other words, this man would have the test. The ELISA test. Western blood test. That takes advantage of the different sizes of, a bit more accurate, the different size of the virus. Per definition, he would be HIV positive. After 2 or 3 months, since he has no virus, the antibody disappears, and he would go to the test back with, oh, I'm cured, I'm HIV negative. This is the explanation why you can have, indeed, you can be, per definition, HIV positive, but have no virus. The other thing that can happen is, and that also explains the remark of Dr. Duisberg, you can take a pint of blood during the ELISA test, for instance, and at that moment, you can even test negative because you see the antibodies and the virus and so forth is not at any parts in the body at the same time. I mean, they can be at the size of the leg while they take something from they take blood from your arm. That happened, that is possible. And you can be free of virus and of antibody and of anything. Even microbial probing would see there's no virus, there's no antibody, there's no nothing. And yet, you know, you are positive. So we have to be so careful with these remarks. This is you know, you cannot generalize. Yes, it's possible, but basically if you have virus, you are HIV positive. Even if you they might take your blood and they might not immediately get your antibodies. Why? Because at that moment they are not there. They might be somewhere else. And now they take the blood, it's just a little bit of blood. And so it is antibody free, correct? But to conclude from that that the whole body has no antibodies is irresponsible.
Professor Duisberg has also said that it has not been shown that retroviruses are carcinogenic, and also that there is no proof that bovine leukemia virus causes bovine leukemia. Please comment on this.
An amazing statement to me, that somebody like Professor Duisberg, who is professor of microbiology, he's not an MD, though he is an expert in retroviruses, his own work as I recall in avian retroviruses prove that they are pathogenic, carcinogenic. But generally you can say that not every retrovirus is carcinogenic. This is correct. In case of the HIV virus, I didn't say that the HIV virus is carcinogenic, but when you have the HIV virus, attacks T and B cells via autoimmunity, syncytia, fusion, and so forth, your immune system is down, and then you have opportunistic infections such as pneumocystis carinii, pneumonia, and so forth. You have also the occurrence of KS. Now, I want to emphasize that Kaposi sarcoma does not necessarily appear, you see how exact we have to be here, does not necessarily appear as a cause of the oppressed immune system. You can have an immune system that is intact and you have Kaposi sarcoma.
Because that's a direct effect of the virus, supposedly,
yes.
Cancer of the blood.
Well, cancer of the blood would be leukemia. Cancer of the blood is not Kaposi sarcoma.
And then what is Kaposi sarcoma?
Kaposi sarcoma is a 100-year-old virus that causes violet, purple-like appearance on the skin and so forth. You know that Kaposi sarcoma per se is a benign cancer. It comes and it goes. It is never appears in women unless they are HIV positive. See, we have to be careful here when we use these terms, Kaposi sarcoma. It's from Max Kaposi, an Austrian dermatologist who discovered that virus. It is basically in Jewish ancestry, European, Italian ancestry, in older men, in Africans. Yes, in Africans. It is benign. It comes and goes. Just in connection with HIV, this virus also causes Kaposi sarcoma in the same way that I can kill you with a knife and with a pistol. The result is both times the same. Just one time, Kaposi sarcoma happens by other causes that we don't want to get into here. Sometimes it's just old age. And I say it again, and you mentioned it, the pleomorphicity of a virus. I say that all viruses are always there. If your immune system or other conditions allow the then benign virus still to turn its nature, namely pleomorph, to become pleomorph, and to turn from benign into malignant. Or do you say malign? No, malignant.
Malignant, yes. Correct.
English. Malignant. Then the same virus that was first harmless becomes now a carcinogen, as we say, or a pathogen, cytopathic and so forth, and can cause disease. It is amazing to me that Professor Duisberg states that retroviruses are not pathogenic when his own work is proving that. I would like to talk personally to him about that, but he abandons his own results.
Professor Duisberg has said that there is no proof that bovine leukemia virus causes bovine leukemia. Please comment on this.
Professor Duisberg, this is a low blow, in case you're listening now. Because, yes, you can also not prove that the cold virus causes the cold. You cannot prove that the hepatitis B virus causes hepatitis B per se, although we know he unleashes the protein molecule on the liver and so forth. We have to stick, in this case, with Robert Koch, who says, well, there has to be virus and there is the diseased tissue. Seen from that point of view, you can say there is no proof for anything. You can prove that water makes you wet, because wet is just a term that you say. The fact is this: when you have bovine leukemia, or when there is a disease such as bovine leukemia, there is a cow virus, there is a bovine leukemia virus. Now, in case of HTLV-1, you might be right, because that virus is not anymore bovine leukemia. It is bovine leukemia put in the human tissue culture, injected in the poor black people in Africa or anybody else. Then you are right. But as to your other objection, that you cannot prove that bovine leukemia causes bovine leukemia, from that point of view, you can prove that any virus causes anything. There is even Gottschalk, who received a Nobel Award, and somebody criticized him and said, who can prove that this virus causes that disease in the brain? Nobody has ever observed a virus causing a disease in a human being. Yeah, how can you do that? You just see the virus there and you assume. Yeah, if from that point of view, Dr. Duisberg, we all should just stop doing what we're doing. You should quit your job, and we should all start from scratch and first prove that the cold virus is causing a cold, because there is no proof for that. So we would have to take somebody who has a cold, and we would have to go into his body and show how that little sucker is causing what we later call a cold. Yeah, Dr. Duisberg, I admire you for your rhetoric, but please, let's be fair and let's start somewhere.
With a miniaturized microscope that travels into
yeah.
them.
Yes, that is a fact. We cannot prove nothing. Yes, that's right. There is a Flat Earth Society also, by the way. And Elvis is alive.
We now conclude Contemporary Communications Conference with Ned Potter, thank you Ned, and Christian Anders, also known as Lanou. Videotapes, audio tapes, and books about the man who created AIDS can be ordered by calling 1-800 859-3177 or write Stoneman Productions, 1223 Wilshire Boulevard, Suite 475, Santa Monica, California, 90403. Lanou will be performing the play The Man Who Created AIDS at the Wildside Theater in North Hollywood. Their number is 818-506-8838. For more information on Contemporary Communication Conference other shows, please send a self-addressed stamped envelope to 2427½ Glendon, GLYNDON, Venice, California, 90291. Thank you.